Welcome to Better Cybersecurity, the ISF podcast. I'm your host, Steve Durbin.
ISF Chief Executive Steve Durbin is an expert in leadership, business culture transformation, and cyber strategies for today's top enterprises. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. In today's episode, Steve is back with Business Matters and Juliet Foster. In this conversation, Steve recaps 2025 in cyber and shares what he sees as the biggest risks of 2026. Steve and Juliet also discuss resilience and compliance, as well as the growing importance of togetherness among businesses.
As 2025 draws to a close, many companies are looking back on a year marked by volatility. U.S. tariffs and geopolitical tensions tested corporate resilience to the nth degree, while a surge in the number of cyber attacks compounded the strain on already stretched systems. Although some firms managed to dodge the attentions of cyber criminals, others weren't so lucky. The British car manufacturer Jaguar Land Rover was one of many high-profile victims. A major cyber attack forced the company to shut down its production line for 5 weeks, slashing UK car output, costing the economy billions, and leaving thousands of suppliers scrambling in confusion. So what lies ahead? Well, I'm joined now by Steve Durbin, who's CEO of the Information Security Forum, whose recent webcast offered a sobering look at the risks and responsibilities facing the C-suite. Steve, it's good to see you. Let's look back at 2025. Was it a good year, a bad year, or in line with what you expected?
Good question. I think from a cyber point of view, I would say it was probably as I'd expected. I think we saw, you know, an increase in some of the breaches, some of the attacks. That was to be expected. As things continue to develop, we're going to see more of that. I think we saw some really good steps from the good guys in terms of defending against some of those attacks as well. So on balance, I think from the corporate standpoint, I would say it was pretty much in line with certainly what I had expected. Not good news if you're one of the ones, of course, that was attacked.
Okay, let's go back to that webcast that I referenced in the introduction, because you talked about four drivers posing the greatest risk going into 2026. Now, the four were AI, third-party risk, quantum computing, and geopolitics. Slightly unfair question, but which of these four poses the biggest danger?
I would probably have to say at the moment, geopolitics, simply because of the degree of uncertainty. Now, in the security space, of course, one of the things that we love to have is a degree of certainty because we can plan for it. We can put in place some of the processes that we need to have in order to be able to combat some of the threats. And certainly if 2026 is anything like 2025, we're going to have a lumpy, bumpy year. And that makes it very difficult to really balance out the needs of different organizations in terms of what they're planning to do. So geopolitics would be my pick.
Okay, we're going to return to that in a few moments. But the other issue that came up in that webcast was quantum computing. Now, okay, a lot of companies feel it's quite far away, but the point that you were making is that we need to give it attention now, even if that wide-scale deployment is at least a decade away. A fair assessment?
Absolutely right, Julia. And the reason for that is simple. It takes a very long time to convert from the current level of encryption, if you like, that people have got, to the new format that we're going to have to go for. And yes, quantum is probably 10 years, depends who you talk to, anywhere between 8 and 14 years, people would say. So I prefer to think of it as 10. Now, if you then look at organizations that are going to need to do something, let's keep it fairly simple. If you're in critical national infrastructure, you're going to have to review everything that you've encrypted. That's probably going to take you a good 10 years. So that may seem like a long time, but to be perfectly honest, governments, very large corporate organizations, the ones that are very concerned about it have already started. If you happen to be a large to mid-size organization, it's probably going to take you something like 6 to 8 years. So you've got time, is the good news, to actually plan it out a little bit. Because you have to look across not just your own corporate estate, but across all of the different areas that you're having to communicate with. So we're bringing in things like supply chain, all of the third parties. So it's not a minor undertaking. And whilst it sounds like a long time, it really won't be once you actually get down to doing it.
Yeah, because the point which came out is that some companies are very divided on this, because yes, there are companies which are moving very quickly, but there are some who perhaps feel quantum computing, it doesn't really impact on us now. We don't need to think about it. But why do you think opinion is so divided?
I think it comes down to what are you actually storing? So if you have a lot of legacy systems where you have been storing personal information, maybe health type information, for instance, and you have encrypted it for very good reason, then you're going to be concerned. You should be concerned, rather, about it. If, on the other hand, you don't tend to keep information for a very long period of time because it's not sensitive, then you can relax a bit. And I think that's the sort of debate that we're seeing. We're seeing those on the one hand that are saying, when I look at the information, it is very sensitive, not just in terms of perhaps personal information, but from a competitive advantage standpoint, they're concerned and are moving to action and thinking maybe it's a little bit late. With some of the others, there's a bit of a lag. The good news is, if you're not encrypting anything, I don't know why you wouldn't be, but if you're not, then you probably don't need to worry too much.
But either which way, it's there, it's on the horizon. At least be aware of it and strategize.
Absolutely. My point is, you need to plan for this, even if you then decide to do nothing.
Now, you mentioned third parties, okay, and supply chains. Let's stick with that, because there have been instances where a third party has suffered a security breach and the reputational damage extends beyond that part of the supply chain to the main company itself. In other words, the company which is at the top, and it's taken company C to be a certain part of that line. Now, in that context, how do you think a board should actually rethink accountability for that supply chain? Because clearly they can't remove themselves from it if that bit fails, even if their own security cordon stays intact.
No, that's right. And I think this is an issue that all companies are now starting to realize, because as you say, you know, in 2025, we saw a very large number of those sorts of attacks, sorts of breaches taking place, whether it be in the manufacturing space, whether it be in transportation, logistics. So no sector is really safe from those kinds of things. So in the boardroom, what should people be doing? They need to be really delving into exactly where their data is flowing, because that for me is the important piece. You have to take the view that says, I have a dispersed ecosystem. I am sharing my information right the way around. And if somebody in some part of the world or some part of my supply chain is attacked or has a breach, what is my exposure? So actually, when you look at it that way, it's good old-fashioned business continuity planning. And it takes away all of this fear and concern about, you know, I've got all of these vendors, I don't know what to do with it. No, you just concentrate down on the key components of your business. What's the minimum viable company going to look like for you? What is the right amount of data you need to be protecting? And then you roll that out across your supply chain, and you will very quickly and very easily identify your hotspots. Once you've identified the hotspots, of course, then you can do something about it. You put the plan in place, you strategize around it. Are you going to have backups? If so, what do they look like? Those are all the sorts of things that you need to do. But actually, it's not a complex process once you start to break it down.
And of course, it's taking responsibility as well. It is being a responsible leader, because that is part of what it's all about.
Absolutely. And the thing is, you made a very good point. Some of the people in the supply chain are perhaps very small companies. They don't have a high reputational profile. You are probably somebody that does have a large profile, and the damage to your reputation can be enormous. Nobody ever bothers to look at whether or not it was the third party. All they know is the big retailer couldn't function. So that's the reputational damage component.
Yeah, it's where the buck stops, basically, in the court of public opinion. But is it time for regulators to actually make third-party risk oversight a statutory obligation for boards? Because, again, this was another point that came out in that webcast, that maybe it takes that level of shake-up to really get things moving.
Yeah, and people who've listened to me talking about this topic in the past will know that I'm not a big fan of regulation, because I like to think that we could get the balance right to allow companies to still be entrepreneurial, still develop their systems and processes without having to worry too much around some of that compliance. And I've said many times, you know, that good compliance doesn't equal good security, but good security does equal, in 9 times out of 10, very good compliance. So where do we go with all of that? I do think that we're probably getting to a point, sadly, where we need to be viewing some of the security processes that we need to undergo in the same way as we consider financial audit. So I do think that smart boards will be insisting on a security audit, if you like, and I think that should be conducted by a third party. I would personally like to see us doing that on a voluntary basis, on an opt-in, rather than a regulator insisting on it, but I suspect that probably won't happen in the majority of cases. So it may well be that we have to move down that road for regulation. But the reason I'm saying it is that it just makes good business sense to me. To have somebody who knows what they're doing come in, take that overall look, audit the key component pieces of your business in much the same way as a financial audit is done, and then you just roll that into the normal business practice. And you can have your reviews that follow on in the board after that. Your senior team knows exactly what they should be doing. So I think there's a lot of benefit in that. It may well be it takes regulation.
Yeah, because I mean, certainly some companies are already doing that, but perhaps not enough given the scale of the risk.
No, that's absolutely right. And, you know, we've just talked about third parties, for instance. So you would want, if you had an extended third party supply chain, to be pushing out some of those things into those areas as well.
When we look back at 2025, I think certainly from my point of view, and I hold my hands up to this, I'm not a security expert, but it's the fact that cybercrime is not only more industrialized, but it's also extremely professional as well. It's not just companies which are having to factor that in. Even unrelated sectors, the espionage trade, is having to take this into account as well. And the point is that evolution has become more advanced with the geopolitics, linking it back to the big threat that you've identified going into 2026.
I think that's right. I come back to a very simple point, and that is society has become very dependent upon technology. If you've become dependent upon technology, you have a security issue. So to your point around cybercrime, yes, it has become very professionalized. Nation states have understood that there's a lot of value in the information that is out there. And espionage, we shouldn't be surprised. It doesn't matter which century you want to go back to. It's been around. Whether or not you were lurking in a corridor, listening to meetings, and then, or whether or not you were writing things down and then sending those off. I was talking to a former head of MI6 who was saying that when he was starting out, he used to be sort of lurking in alleys and things, you know, getting soaking wet, listening to stuff. Now, there's no need for your everyday spies.
Surveillance as well, the cameras.
Exactly. You can do it from the kitchen, from the living room, from the office, from wherever. So the whole thing has changed completely. What I think is interesting, though, is when we look at all of that advance in technology, with a sort of wry smile, I notice that, you know, it's fashionable to go back to some of these paper-driven approaches because you can't hack a bit of paper.
It's just got to store it somewhere safely.
Exactly. And NCSC, not so long ago as well, in the UK, of course, talked about the fact that don't rubbish a paper backup. It can be very useful. So I think that even though we're all getting excited about technology and all the different things that we have to do with that, there is still quite a nice place, I think, for some of the old-fashioned stuff.
The interesting thing is that, okay, some companies are more aware of dangers than others, and certainly the very aware category, they also factor in geopolitics, and that's the point. Do you think that companies fully understand how geopolitical entanglements can actually complicate this cyber vulnerability, especially when you've got attackers who are operating under the protection of a rogue state? Once upon a time, I would never have asked you that question, but we're in this reality now.
Yeah, that is absolutely right. I think there is a requirement for companies that are operating certainly across multiple jurisdictions to really look very, very long and hard at what the risks and the challenges might be in those areas. And of course, you will then put cybercrime or breaches, attacks, that kind of thing, into that context. I think as well, we've had to wake up to the fact that if you are working in, I come back to it, critical national infrastructure, and you are a key player in that space, then you will be under significant attack at some point in time, if not already. And so you do have to take these things into account. And one of the encouraging things that I've certainly seen, I would say, over the past few years, is boards waking up to that understanding, really scenario planning out some of these.
But these tend to be boards which operate in the area of infrastructure.
Absolutely, they do. And I think with some of the others are somewhat slow to the party, if you put it that way, but I think they're getting there.
Yeah, so it's the larger companies leading by example, effectively.
Absolutely. And I think there is a requirement as well on those companies to actually share some of that. And again, I come back to the supply chain, that's a good way of doing it.
But also it's the perception as well, and perhaps governments have to lead it in that sense. In other words, you have to look at it in terms of a strategic national risk. So if governments lead the way in terms of that line of thinking, then other companies can perhaps follow suit too, the way that it's perceived.
You do. And I think that this really touches on quite an interesting piece, which is the political component. We talk about geopolitics, but actually we probably don't drill down enough into the key political piece of it, because you mentioned governments. Governments are driven by politics. And yes, some of them have woken up to the fact that this can be weaponized. Others have woken up to the fact that they need to be playing a very strong defensive game, depending on where they happen to be in the world. And governments are very rarely operating in isolation. They have to work with large corporates. They have to work with other companies. It really is this sort of public-private partnership, if you like, that we need to be focusing on within that overall geopolitical context. And that's where it starts to get difficult, because what you don't want to do is have governments influencing the way that companies behave for political ends.
So that's a lesson to be learned in terms of the relationship between the two. But at the same time, 2025, we also saw attacks on infrastructure, obviously abroad, some very high-profile cases there. But what are the lessons that boards themselves can learn from that, especially when an attack has led to prolonged disruption and the users of that service are baying for normality very quickly?
I think you have to plan for it. I talk a lot about the need for resilience. I think that the day is gone when you can rely on your defenses. So boards have to be planning for the day when the defenses fail, when attack really starts to make an impact on your business. The starting point is to figure out how long you can be without your systems. It may sound like a strange thing to say, but that's the important starting point for me. Some organizations, it may be not that long at all. For others, it may be that they could survive without their core system, but for a number of days, because that then tends to focus the mind on the importance and indeed the amount of money, resources that you're going to need to put in place to build out your resilience. What you're trying to do is to make sure that you're protecting your key elements of data, that you're protecting the people that are going to need to get the systems back up and running. And so you need to plan for that day. Having planned for it, you then need to rehearse it. And you need to do that rigorously from the board right the way down. And that, to a lot of people, seems to be like money wasted. It's not money wasted if you're attacked, because then the muscle memory within the organization kicks in and you're able to respond. I'll give you an example. Not in 2025, we had a boarding pass check-in system that went down right the way across Europe. Some people may remember this, particularly if they were trying to get a flight out of somewhere like Berlin or somewhere, and the whole thing came to a grinding halt. However, there was one airline that was still able to operate. And the simple reason for that was they were able to use a fallback system that was a former version of the software. Those are just very simple examples. You've got a backup in place. You're planning for the day that something goes wrong. Of course, you don't want it to happen.
But it could.
But you know what to do. Mm. And so you can still function.
But how often should you have these rehearsals, the scenario planning rehearsals? I mean, are we talking once a year, once every 2 years? Because as you said, you don't know when an attack will occur.
No, and I think it depends very much on how quickly you're changing your systems and your approaches. I would say that good practice for me would be once a year. Some organizations might say, well, okay, every year we'll do a light touch and we'll do a heavy duty version in year two. I'm fine with that as well, because what that's telling me is that they've got a plan. The people I worry about are those that are still flying a little bit by the seat of the pants, don't have a plan, hope it doesn't happen.
A fingers crossed approach.
Yeah, you can't do that anymore. You simply can't.
Yeah, but then I suppose that the flip side of that is, okay, we can actually have these rehearsals, etc., but there are no limits on scenarios. So what scenario are we responding to? They're infinite.
They are, to a certain extent, but I think that you could also be somewhat realistic about it. So if you're having to moving into a new market, for instance, you would do a proper risk assessment on that before you moved into it. That might highlight some issues that you hadn't considered in your sort of status quo business. You would then plug those into a scenario. If you are moving into a different product line, if you are moving into critical infrastructure, so big changes that you're starting to see in your business, you will throw those into the mix and you will plan for those. Otherwise, again, and you know, I've said this a few times now, you have to go back to what is absolutely essential. What are the crown jewels in your organization? You have to protect them at all costs, because if you don't, you don't have a business.
But what this does is that it changes the way that boards operate. Indeed, it alters the way that they delegate. And that's what I want to focus on. Is the current delegation still fit for purpose? Or do you think that cyber risk perhaps demands direct board level authority? In other words, if something goes wrong in the chain, rather than the board saying, well, actually, that's the job of the IT department, it's like, hang on a minute, we can't live in that world. It may have sufficed 30, 40, 50 years ago, but not now.
I think we're having to move away from very hierarchical systems and approaches. I talk a lot about adaptive governance, which is about empowering people at the appropriate level in the organization to take some of the decisions that you're talking about. Ultimately, of course, the board remains responsible. And so they have to be comfortable that the people they're devolving the decision-making authority to know what they're doing and that they're getting the right information when they absolutely need it.
Stay with me on this because, look, I want to focus on boards reporting on cyber risk. What do you see as the most meaningful measures of exposure? Are we looking at things like attack surface reduction, perhaps vendor risk, or crypto risk? And coming out of that, how do you think boards can make sure that they're getting real, genuine insight rather than being overwhelmed by things like the dashboards and data points?
Yeah, I think that if you're a security professional watching this, then we all love our dashboards. We love to have the lights and the flashes and all of that sort of thing. If you're a board member and you're watching this, you probably haven't got the first clue what it means. So what does it look like from a boardroom metric standpoint? You have to be reporting in the language of the business. You have to be reporting in a language that the board understands. There is no point inundating them with dashboards, telling them what a wonderful job you're doing in terms of repelling all of these attacks. They are not interested. It doesn't mean anything to them. You have to speak the language that they understand. So good board metrics have to look at a return on investment. They have to be looking at, is our technology, are our security processes facilitating our growth strategy? Are they protecting our customers' data? Are they protecting our employees? So those are the sorts of things that boards will land on. When I always talk to boards, I always say, show me your risk register. Let's start with that because you understand that. So now let's look at which of those risks can be impacted by technology or by security. And so you're actually reducing some of the work there just by being a little bit smarter. I think a lot of people, when they talk about metrics for the board, suddenly think you have to produce, you know, a mammoth amount. You may well need it as from a security leader perspective, and that's absolutely fine. The board isn't going to look at it. If you're reporting to a board, they are interested in how well is this company doing with regard to the progress that we set out, the strategy that we have, the revenue we thought we were going to generate, the new products we were going to take to market, and our employee base. And of course, our consumers and customers.
Given what is happening, do you sense that perhaps there's more cooperation that's going on, that there has to be that cooperation in the sense that we've had assaults on the financial sector, and there's almost a very familial approach to it, certainly in terms of thinking. In other words, if Bank A gets attacked, okay, the banks around that institution are safe, but an attack against one is an attack against all. Is it time for the business community to embrace that mentality? We need to be together. We need to share.
I think it is. And you raise a very good example there of the banks. The banks have been doing that for a very, very long time. And of course, they have some of the most advanced systems out there in terms of identifying and responding to some of these attacks. So certainly there is going to be a need, I think, for us to embrace a much more, and I would say, cross-industry approach to sharing information. Critical national infrastructure, they're already doing it as well because they have to. But I think that security is not, in my opinion anyway, a competitive advantage. And because it's not a competitive advantage, there shouldn't be this massive barrier to sharing some of the ideas, some of the attacks that are out there for the good of the industry. And so cross-industry, I like the idea of that. I think the reality is we're probably still going to be looking at it from a segmented vertical market.
That's the point that I was going to raise as well, because yes, you can understand those who operate in the financial sector working together that way, those in infrastructure. But it needs to go deeper than that.
It does need to go deeper than that. And I think that at the deepest level that it has to go, it's about you and I. It's about what are we doing? Because, you know, we are users of the technology. We go to work and we're sitting there at our keyboards doing whatever it is. So we have to be sharing at the individual level as well. And of course, we are also users of technology and we need to understand why the bank is asking us to do what the bank is asking us to do from a security standpoint, and what do we find acceptable. So I think that it really does cross over every element of society from an individual user all the way up to the largest corporation.
Yeah, a connected journey, basically. Let's stay with that idea because we've seen how the threat of cyber attacks are reshaping the way that companies are doing business because they have to build this awareness into their day-to-day structures. And you're seeing this clearly in the way that CEOs and CFOs are making decisions? Do you feel that they're more digitally accountable? Because yes, we talked about the structure of boards, but in terms of that accountability, has it actually penetrated there?
I think it depends very much on the sorts of companies that you're talking about. I think that obviously if you happen to be working in the tech space, that's the way you've been doing it. Most CEOs that I know tend to be quite data-driven individuals, as indeed do CFOs. So there's a common language there is the point I'm making. But there's also a very real concern because CEOs, CFOs are very focused on data integrity because we make decisions based on that data. So it has to be right. And I think that is the way that we ought to be viewing security. How are we protecting the integrity of data? Because that's so important because we're making decisions on it. Not just people making decisions on it, AI is making decisions based on it. So all of the different elements now of the technology ecosystem are using data. And we have to make sure that it's protected. We have to make sure that we understand where it's come from. And we have to make sure that we can trust it.
Understanding its potential.
Absolutely.
Okay, Steve Durbin, plenty to think about for 2026. But thank you so much for joining us. That was Steve Durbin, who's CEO of the Information Security Forum, sharing his thoughts and predictions for 2026.
That was ISF Chief Executive Steve Durbin on Business Matters.
Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with more expert insights and thought-provoking discussions. But in the meantime, if you really enjoyed today's episode, please take a moment to rate, review, and share the podcast. If you're interested in becoming an ISF member or continuing the conversation further, please do get in touch with me at steve.durbin@securityforum.org or indeed get hold of me on LinkedIn. And remember, you can explore all our media and resources at our website, securityforum.org.